Well, good evening, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. Let me welcome you to the London School of Economics for this, our last event of the LISE calendar. For anyone who might not be familiar, LISE is our research unit on Southeast Europe that we have based at the European Institute. And I'm absolutely delighted to be able to welcome such a guest for the last speaker of this academic year. I believe that for most of you in this room, he will need absolutely no introduction. But for anyone who might not be aware, I'll just give you a little bit of a background to our speaker, His Excellency Daniel Mitov, Foreign Minister of the Republic of Bulgaria. Minister Mitov graduated from Sofia University, St. Clement Oriski, with a degree in political science. He's participated in the International Exchange Programme of the Marshall Memorial Fund and the programme of the French Foreign Ministry of Foreign, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and specialised in political skills at the Centre for Continuing Education at the New Bulgarian University. In 2002, he worked at the Political Academy for Central and Southeast Europe as part of the Bulgarian School of Politics team and Razum magazine. In 2006, he became Executive Director of the Democracy Foundation and then Vice President of Democrats for Strong Bulgaria Party. He has participated in the establishment of Bulgaria for the Citizens Political Party. Since the autumn of 2010, he worked for the United States National Democratic Institute, NDI, in Iraq, where he was Programme Manager of the Political Party Development Programme. As an official of the NDI, he's also worked in Brussels, Libya, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ukraine, Yemen, Tunisia, and others. The subject of his speech this evening is EU foreign policy, the view from Bulgaria. Minister.
Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. It's a real pleasure to be tonight with you, and it's a real privilege to be here in this institution, which has been always known for being one of those places where ideas are born and where leaders are born as well. Right now, when I was listening to the kind introduction, I was thinking, where is in my bio LSE? Unfortunately, until this moment, now we are starting some kind of a history in that regard as well. When I shared with a friend that I'll be here and speaking in front of you, and asked him for an advice how to approach this. This statement or lecture or whatever we can call it, he told me, use the miniskirt tactics. Then he said, well, it needs to be long enough in order to cover all the details, but also short enough in order to keep everyone's attention. So I'll try to somehow do this and leave enough time for questions and answers. I'll try to paint a little bit of a picture of what we see and how we see the geopolitics today and the dynamic geopolitical situation. And if anyone thinks they've had a bad day until now, just wait to see what I'm going to say. The challenges in front of the European Union are quite a lot, and what we're trying to focus on is always tackled by something else. So there's not really time to really concentrate on one issue and solve it and then go to another. The dynamic is so high, and we are trying to juggle with so many issues that at a certain point I'm really afraid that we're focusing on everything and on nothing at the same time. In terms of economy, investment is moving east. It's moving from Central Asia to Far East, and we're facing crisis there We, for years, we were suffering from growth reduction and stalling of growth, which means we need to somehow adjust and upgrade our economic model. I mean, the European Union one. There are a lot of questions over competitiveness and demographic challenges in Europe. Democratic as well, but demographics is of particular concern, especially for countries like mine, which is losing human capital all the time, every single year. Temptations to prefer bilateral economic cooperation track on every level, being with Russia or with Asian countries, is also part of the narrative inside of the European Union. So all that brings us to a lot of questions on how to react and what to do. Of course, one of the most obvious things is to try and complete the single market or reach a point of completion of the EU single market, to an extent in which it will be more competitive, it will deepen the Eurozone integration and governance, and it will add more investments on new engines of growth and competitiveness, which means also tearing down certain administrative barriers in front of the business and making Europe really, really competitive. But that's the internal dimension. The external one, and the most urgent one, which I see, is the transatlantic trade agreement. For many, many reasons, geopolitical and economical, we need to complete that as soon as possible. That is my firm belief. Of course, this needs to happen in the most transparent way possible, so that everyone knows what the European Commission is negotiating, what are the conditions, what are the standards and the norms which are in the basics of this agreement. Because there's a lot of mythology around what will happen if eventually this agreement takes place and how it will shape the European economy or the American economy. All the serious studies show that it's a good thing. And I remember in Bulgaria, when we were about to join the European Union, everyone was scaring us with how the European economy all of a sudden will overwhelm us, how there will be no Bulgarian businessmen in the country, all the European corporations will just wipe out the Bulgarian entrepreneurs and so on and so forth, not to mention the other myths and legends out there. Well, nothing of this happened. I mean, a lot of investment came, there was economic growth, of course, till 2008 it was a little bit higher than now, but that's a natural thing. Everyone was affected by the economic crisis. Now there's a little bit of a, let's say, restoration of the growth, and we can see how the growth is a little bit retaking its course and is beginning to shift back to its previous volumes, let's put it this way. That's one thing. What did I do? I clicked something. Then, when it comes to increased security risks in the greater or bigger geopolitical context, something that I'm trying to mention everywhere where I'm invited to speak, and which is my deep conviction, is that we are in a very new geopolitical situation after the annexation of Crimea. But not only that, then we realized it, or a lot of us realized it. It started happening way before that. So after the fall of the Berlin Wall, there was a deep conviction that the history has ended. Liberal democracy will take over little by little. The the growing interdependence in economic terms will be the vehicle through which liberal institutions and liberal democratic values will kind of change autocratic regimes and push them and force them to liberalize and democratize. That was the massive thinking and conviction. Well, and that is why we stopped making history. We thought it was over. We thought that now we need to little by little push. Well, when you stop making history, someone else is bound to start making it for you. And that's what happened to us, to the European Union. Thank God the European Union's enlargement and NATO's enlargement added up to the number of the liberal democracies in the world. So now the liberal democratic world is a bit stronger to face the new challenges. But the liberal democratic model already has alternatives. And the biggest ones are ISIS. That's a completely new understanding and different understanding of what our understanding is of how society should function, of what are the fundamental values of a society. And the other one is the Russian model. Russians openly say Europe and the transatlantic community are trying to impose on us values which we don't share, which we don't believe in. Well, very well. But this means that we need to start drawing lines and borders again between the democratic world and the rest. And we need to start much actively defending our values, defending our principles on which we base the functioning of our societies, strengthen that, and remain persistent on what we believe in. Because otherwise we see penetration all the time through different means. We see penetration in our societies of different philosophies which challenge liberal democracy and part of the liberal democratic values. I'm not going to go into detail in that. You all know probably what I'm referring to. But that is of great concern, and we need to tackle it, and we need to realize it as soon as possible. A lot of people have already realized that, but I think we have a little bit more work to do in that regard in order to be able on European level to craft consistent policies. The fracture of state systems in North Africa and the Middle East is of particular concern for us. The borders will not be the same after some time, whether we want it or not. The Syrian crisis, the Libyan crisis, the crisis in Yemen are actually putting us in front of other challenges which we right now we're trying to find out how to respond to. Because if we put boots on the ground, that will mean that we will try to explain afterwards that we're not the crusaders and we're not launching some kind of religious wars. If we don't, we see what happens. People die. People are getting displaced. People are trying to flee into Europe where it's safe and where they can find certain type of protection and have security at least, which we can't blame them for that. So this dilemma, how to resolve that, is again a huge problem. And of course the region of Southeastern Europe, which is of our particular concern when it comes to Bulgaria. Well, we see that little by little the enthusiasm for European Union membership in those countries is fading away, together with the enthusiasm for enlargement inside the European Union. There's a fatigue from the enlargement. So how to keep this running is another challenge. We need to be very firm on how to give the motivation and stimulates all our neighbors from the Western Balkans, for example, to continue with the reforms, to be firm on those reforms which are needed, because we need to keep our conditionality, more for more. We need to keep that, and that is clear. More reforms for more perspectives for integration. But at the same time, if we are withdrawn and if we don't show clear perspective on when enlargement can happen, then there are forces inside those candidate countries which are trying to use the situation and actually misinform the public that actually enlargement will never happen. The rhetoric is actually quite hard on that. The West is colonizing you, making you do things, but they will never give you anything. And it comes from somewhere else, and you know what I'm referring to. That's actually a huge problem for us, because we need to understand how to keep that balance, keep the enthusiasm of those countries strong, and at the same time be sure that we don't offer enlargement before those countries are ready. So that's more or less what we can say in the beginning for Southeastern Europe. And I'm just coming from our friends and colleagues in Skopje, in the Republic of Macedonia, because you know that it's quite a difficult and challenging situation right now there. We're trying to help. We want to see the Republic of Macedonia one day a member of the European Union and NATO. But not so long time ago, we were told, from somewhere else, that us, Bulgarians and the Albanians, are trying to split Macedonia. We're trying to divide it. So we were very, very clear that the European Union, we responded to that. But we need to know that the European Union does not move borders. It removes them. And you know that better than anyone else. We need more integrated Europe. We need complete Europe. It will happen. It will happen with the time. But there will be a lot of challenges along the road. And of course, we're trying to help our neighbors and our colleagues in the Republic of Macedonia, just to be clear that we want nothing else but European and Euro-Atlantic future for our neighboring country in this case. The same is valid for Serbia. Same is valid for Bosnia. Same is valid for Montenegro. For Albania. Little by little, this needs to happen. But it's quite challenging, and not very well determined in time. So, by no means, I don't want to exhaust you with the length of my speech, and as I mentioned in the beginning, I'll try to keep it short in order to give a little bit more time for questions and try to respond to them, of course. So the common foreign and security policy of the European Union needs to, in order to conclude, we have that, but it needs to be strengthened, and it needs to take a different shape, as all the other elements that we are talking about that needs to be reformed and deeper integrated. So thank you very much. I'm looking forward to your questions. I hope that this was a good basis for discussion. Thank you. Shall I sit? Okay.
Thank you very much indeed. We do in fact have a little while to pose some questions. I'll abuse privilege of being chair to get the ball rolling with a couple of questions. Of course, you're here in Britain to have meetings with members of the British government, and the key issue here at the moment is, well, you are aware, is the EU referendum that's coming up, and the British government's desire to see some sort of reform of the European Union. I don't think we're entirely clear exactly what it's going for, but perhaps you can enlighten us as to how do you see it in your discussions? I mean, obviously, one of the key issues in the debate here is about immigration. A number of things have been said about trying to introduce curbs, whether that's on numbers or on the benefits that people coming from across the European Union can receive. Now, we've heard some very outspoken statements, for example, from the Polish government on this. How does Sofia see this? The second question goes to a very, very different direction, and that's on the United Nations. And we have the next Secretary General is going to have to be appointed at some point next year. Bulgaria, I think, is in a rather unique position that there are two truly outstanding candidates who not only fulfill the fact that the expectation is the next candidate, next Secretary General will come from Eastern Europe, but the hope that the next Secretary General will also be a woman. Perhaps you can comment a little bit on where your government stands on that at the moment. Thank you.
Well, to begin with the issue for the EU referendum here in Britain, well, you know, I wouldn't go into too much detail about whether it's right, whether it's not. I mean, this is something which is an internal debate, internal political debate, which is of major priority for the British government, with which we have excellent relations. And we're trying to somehow coordinate positions around our trio EU presidency, because as you know, 2017-2018, UK, Estonia and Bulgaria will be presiding the European Union. So there, we need to find ways in order to coordinate our priorities and programs and have enough continuity in between those priorities. So there's so many things on the table and questions flying around that we first need to see black and white what would be the suggestions of the British government in order to comment deeply into the every single issue. That's one thing. The next thing is, of course, we will stand for the principle of free movement within the European Union. That's clear. And this is the heart and the soul of the European Union as a whole. So if we don't preserve that, that's not a way forward at all. But besides that, of course, we understand the concerns which large part of the British population has around misuse of the social welfare system and trying to find ways, institutional ways, in order to limit that. That's a national prerogative of the British government, and we understand that. But it doesn't have to. It doesn't need, or it must not impede the freedom of movement, and it must not be used or crafted in a way that it discriminates against anyone, citizens of the UK or EU citizens who came to work here. They work in under one and the same conditions, and all of a sudden have different ways of treatment in the labour market. So those are the two pillars and the main principles which we will stand for, and we're very, very open about this with our colleagues. But of course, we have quite a lot of things which we can stand together for, and I mentioned some of them. The completion of the single market is one of them. The completion of the digital single market is another one. energy union. We talk all the time about this, and this is something that needs to take shape as soon as possible. Energy security in Europe right now is of utmost importance, and we need to pay attention to it every single day and be sure that the interconnectivity, the gas interconnectivity, the electricity interconnectivity, takes place under the auspices of the European Commission, but also with the consensus of all the member states. Because if we reach the point at which, the point in which we are able to deliver gas from Spain to Bulgaria or from Greece to Holland, from different sources, could be Azeri gas, it could be Kurdish gas, it could be Turkmeni gas, one day maybe Iranian gas, LNG gas, flowing in this gas system that is interconnected, it means that we have reached the point, and Russian gas, of course, as well. If we can create a stock market where countries can actually buy at entry point, that would be the complete gas energy union, which we are really looking for, and we can do. We can deliver on that. It just needs strong will. But we don't have to all the time respond to bluffs. In every single moment in which there's a Gazprom bluff, we start crafting projects for different, you know, pipes and circles and I don't know what else. That's the problem. We have to be focused and know what do we want, and know that we need to decrease our dependence on Russian gas. That's clear. We've said it openly. But now we have to go and do it. On the second question around the UN. Yes, Bulgaria is in a unique position. The former government has taken a decision to support Ms. Bokova, who's the head of UNESCO right now. No matter what kind of... there are a lot of rumors around. But I have to say the following. The Bulgarian government has its campaign plan. We will, of course, inform our partners about the developments. We will seek for support for the Bulgarian candidate, and we'll have a strong candidate. I'm absolutely sure. No matter the name, we will have a strong candidate, and we're absolutely sure that she will have a lot of chances.
I'm not really a betting man, but if I were to put a little bit of money on the next Secretary General, I think I'd be heading Bulgaria's way. I think it's sort of looking very good. So let's keep fingers crossed for that. Dr. Timo Becev, I would just like to say, before we go any further, that acknowledge our great thanks to Dimo for his part in facilitating this evening as a senior research fellow here at LSE. So thank you very much, Dimo. The floor's yours.
Mr. Minister, it's great to have you here, and I think you promised us a very depressing evening, but let you articulate a very forceful and, shall I say, inspiring vision of what is there. And obviously, talking about Southeast Europe is close to the heart of everyone here present. But if we bring a bit more political doom and gloom, and look at Bulgaria, maybe also to go back to your career as a national politician. Bulgaria since 2007 hasn't been quite the good example of why development works. On the contrary, it's been quoted as one of the cases of, if not failure, difficulty, and the transformative mission the EU espouses isn't quite what it's supposed to be. Now, Can you, when you go to Brussels or one of the big capitals and you want to argue a positive case that the Western Balkans should be embraced, possibly other countries as well, what would be your answer to the skeptics? And what are the one or two or three positive developments, despite all the tensions, despite all the headwinds in Bulgaria, that has actually worked? My second question, if I can, is the country that shall not be mentioned. Well, if you look at the polls in Bulgaria, about 2/3 of the population has a favorable view of Russia. But you forcefully maintained kind of solidarity in Brussels, but also Bulgaria has gone along with the consensus. And very often, as we know, foreign policy starts at home. How do you make the case against sometimes very skeptical population that the sanctions is something good, that keeping a common line in Ukraine is something good for everyone? And how do you make this argument in the domestic debate?
With your permission, I'll take one more question as well. Gabriel Partosh. Perhaps, if you could just introduce yourself.
Yes, I'm Gabriel Partosh from the Economist Intelligence Unit. Minister, you mentioned in your presentation that Bulgaria has been helping its friends and colleagues in Macedonia in the attempt to join the EU and at least develop accession groups and, of course, NATO. I was wondering if you could elaborate perhaps in what way Bulgaria is able to help. And in that same context, you also mentioned that an accusation directed against Bulgaria and Albania in the past that they might want to divide up and partition Macedonia. But of course, as you said, the EU is about removing borders, not moving borders. Just on that note, if I could just take you kind of slightly sideways and ask you, talking about borders within the EU, when do you expect and under what circumstances will Bulgaria be able to join the Schengen zone?
Okay. Right. First, we know each other. We've been there for quite a long time. We're good friends, and I want to thank him for everything he has done for me to be here first and to everyone else. And this is the first time he refers to me as Mr. Minister. That's quite weird. Second, when it comes to the problems of Bulgaria, yes. And I remember back at the time when we were in opposition. I wouldn't say that now. But back then, there was a moment in which, I think it was in 2009, two years after Bulgaria joined the European Union, there was a journalist who asked me, I was deputy chair of that party you heard before about. This journalist asked me, what do you think Bulgaria has given to the European Union in 2 years of its membership? And I very honestly and openly then responded very spontaneously. He said, well, probably a reason to invent an exclusion mechanism. That was the case back then. And the government we had was not helping at all. Then I remembered a moment from the farmer, George Orwell. And you probably, most of you, remember this scene where, or this moment in the book, when the animals take over the farm, they start inventing different committees. And one of those committees is named literally Committee for Training Committee for Training the Wild Comrades. Very often, we think of ourselves on the Balkans and the European Union as such a committee that needs to come and tame us and train us somehow. And we don't realize that many things depend on us. That's what it is. The European Union and NATO and everyone else can help. But we need to do the things ourselves. When it comes to the judicial reform, no one is going to come and do it for us. We need to do it ourselves. And that's what we're doing right now. This government is changing even the, or has the the intention to change even the constitution, which is hard exercise in Bulgaria, to be very honest. I hope we will be able to do that. It's a very complicated, Dima knows that very well, it's a very complicated parliament, very powerful. It's not easy to get everyone together behind something, but we're quite optimistic about the prospects of changing the constitution and bringing the necessary change into the judicial system so that it can work more efficiently, more quickly, and deliver actual justice and be accessible to the Bulgarian citizens. We'll see the results of that. There are no perfect reforms. For sure, there will be further problems which we will need to tackle again and again and again, exactly the way how every democracy has developed. No one has invented the perfect institution from day one. This country has centuries of tradition in democracy building until it has reached the point where that's the necessary institutional trust and efficiency. We are a country, as most of the countries from the Balkans, with very short democratic tradition and very short democratic memory. So we need to compensate. And we do. I mean, right now we have the knowledge from everyone else. We're trying to implement it and we're trying to do it. So there are many other, of course, areas, but the judicial reform is the one that we are usually mentioning very often, and it is related to your question as well. When it comes to the second part, when it comes to Schengen, for example, we're ready a long time ago to be part of Schengen. The problem is that the CVM or the reform in the judicial system is linked by some countries with the Schengen issue, even if they have nothing to do with each other. But there's a bit of a, you know, this feeling that Bulgaria needs to be pushed and forced to do certain things, which is fine. But in a situation, in this situation in which we are right now, when we need to fight the phenomenon foreign fighters, we need full access to the Schengen information system. Otherwise, fighting foreign fighters is a problem. There are many, many other ways to do that, but without full access to the information system of Schengen, that will not be complete, and that will not be this fight will lack a very important instrument. Also, Schengen, full access to Schengen is something that we are looking for, but we can start with something small. We can start with opening the air borders and the maritime ones. Then the land borders, we can leave them for a little bit longer time to be opened. That's a reasonable thing to do, and we're trying to talk this with our colleagues. For a very long time already, Bulgaria has proven itself as a quite reliable, very reliable outer border of the European Union, especially when it comes to the border with Turkey. Here I have to say we have good cooperation with our Turkish colleagues and friends, and they help us a lot in that. It's in their interest as well, but it is something that that we do. But anyway, those are all arguments to say Schengen needs to be, the decision for Schengen and for inclusion of Bulgaria needs to be taken as soon as possible, and we need to be to have at least a roadmap or certain steps which needs to be implemented. The sanctions, the skepticism at home, and how do we explain this? Well, Dimo, you know that it's one of the most painful questions for me, because very often when we speak about the fact that we need to be aware that international law is something extremely important, and not applying to that, not implementing it, and breaching in such a violent and criminal manner as Russia did vis-à-vis Crimea means that no one is secure anymore. There are many, many other arguments, of course. But no matter what kind of arguments we're trying to use, the skepticism still remains. But it is embedded also within the so-called hybrid war we talk about all the time. The so-called propaganda. It's not so-called, it's a propaganda from the other side, which relies on blunt and utter lies. As certain people lied to us in the very beginning that there are no Russian troops in Crimea. There's just self-organized people. So, and then there was a documentary made about the operation and how Crimea was turned back to Russia. So we need to fight that as well. We need to tackle that as well. We need to be very clear, and we need to know that we live in a situation towards which we are not fully adequate, and we are not responding very well to what is already coming up, coming from the other side towards us, and is ruining the trust of our citizens towards our own institutions and our own politicians, and even the international legal framework. That's something we need to tackle as soon as possible, and we don't have an answer still. We have ideas here and there. Let's do this, let's do that. But those are fragmentary. Those are very very small bits and pieces. We don't have a big strategy, let's put it this way. And everyone knows that. And in the end, about Macedonia, about the Republic of Macedonia, we have a lot of ways to help our friends and colleagues. We've done that in the past. The relations recently are not really at the pinnacle of their positive approach, but what we tried to do in our last visit is, for example, to try and convince everyone from the political parties and the government to enter the debate about and the negotiation process about the Good Neighbourly Relations Agreement. Of that, for Bulgaria, will solve a lot. That will solve as well a lot for the Republic of Macedonia. I mean, Bulgaria could be a strong advocate, or and also could be a strong, let's say, promoter of reforms. Because we've done a lot. We've gone a long road. We've done good things. We've done mistakes. The good things we can share, but we will share the mistakes as well. The smart people are learning from the mistakes of the others, right? And our neighbors are smart people. So they can learn at least not to repeat what we have done bad. It's easy to say, and I know you realize that, but it's easy to vocalize it. It's very difficult to do it. But anyway, that's the road ahead. There's a road ahead. And also in the framework of, the different regional cooperation initiatives. We took the chairmanship in office recently of the Southeastern European cooperation process. So basically, this is a good framework where we can initiate a document which talks about and guarantees the untouchability of the borders in the region and talks about territorial integrity of certain countries and their and the guarantees that the neighbors have no intentions of changing that or claiming anything. So in that regard, we can help a lot, because the implications from other places will be a lot, and that we need to fight exactly that phenomenon. I hope I answered your question.
Okay. We haven't got a lot more time, so what I'm going to do is take four questions. And the lady there, and then the gentleman just in front of her. And if you could introduce yourself and perhaps keep the question relatively short.
Okay. So my name is Veselina Hinovska. And I'm living working in Bulgaria, and I'm living working in the UK. So my question is about the energy union. I'd like to know what is the government doing to raise Bulgaria's profile to what it used to be back in the 90s when it was exporting cheap electricity to our neighbors.
Gentlemen in front.
Thank you, Minister. My name is Ivalo Yejiev, PhD student at the University of Oxford. Just sort of keeping the question brief, I was just wondering whether I could hear your thoughts on the situation in Greece, given that it's dominating the headlines right now and given the large exposure of the Bulgarian banking system to Greenbacks. Thank you.
Good question. Kiro.
Kiro Drazov at Kiel University. Your Excellency, your last words on the friends and colleagues in Skopje, you mentioned about problems in bilateral relations.
Right.
What is your personal approach to this new bilateral treaty that is being proposed by Bulgaria? Would it be simply a restatement of the 1999 declaration, or there is something new to it?
Thank you. Vesely.
Vesely Dimitrov, I'm an associate professor here at the LSE. Minister, we're delighted to have you here. My question would perhaps invert some of the previous questions which focused on the impact of the EU on Bulgaria. Based on your experience as Foreign Minister, what do you think Bulgaria can bring to the making of EU foreign policy? You provided a very good analysis of the challenges of EU foreign policy, but those challenges are common challenges. So when I was listening to you, I wondered what Bulgaria specifically can contribute.
Good question. Very nice questions. Well, let's start with the energy union. As you know, the energy union is not only about gas, it's also about electricity. And as I mentioned at certain points, the key issue here is to interconnect, to be capable of transmitting gas and electricity from one part of Europe to the other without any on market-based principles. The world is changing. Bulgaria, back in time, probably exported a lot of electricity to Turkey. But Turkey is building nuclear plants. So it will somehow, at a certain point, close a huge gap of its needs by producing its own electricity. We were exporting to other countries, which are also developing their own facilities in order to do that. But if we really want to be able and to be sure that whatever surplus we produce, we can sell, that's always possible within a bigger integrated European market. Because there are always deficits here and there. And an integrated system can actually allow a country like Bulgaria and even Romania to be sure that whatever they produce as a surplus could be exported. And that's for sure. There are calculations about that. So that is why we're pushing for a regional integrated electricity market as well, besides the gas. Because, you know, we talk all the time about gas, but at the same time, only 13% of Bulgaria's energy mix is gas. Everything else is other sources. Actually, it's 20% green energy. We have reached, very long time ago already, we have reached this threshold which was set by the European institutions on green energy. So this is good for everyone to know here. But more integrated and more interlinked European market will allow us and everyone else actually to trade electricity and to be sure that that we put in use the surplus which we produce, even right now. So that's one. Situation in Greece and the Bulgarian banking system. Situation in Greece, I wouldn't want to give advice to anyone in this very complicated situation. It could be interpreted not in the way I actually intend to say something. But whatever the choices are, we as a government have already taken measures in order to be sure that eventual major crisis in Greece when it comes to its banking system will not affect Bulgaria in a devastating manner. Let's put it this way. So the banks which are the Greek banks which are represented in Bulgaria are already aware that they need to follow certain rules. I'm not going to enter in detail. Maybe the Minister of Finance of ours will be more able to walk you through that if he comes here at some point. But that has been already calculated and taken care of with the instruments that we possess as EU country and with the instruments that exist within the national and the EU framework. On the Republic of Macedonia's agreement on good neighborly relations, you know that this is rolling on for a very long time already. And the agreement was between the two presidents is that the declaration of 99 will be transformed into an agreement plus an annex or a document which will guarantee the implementation of this agreement, which is more than what we had right now because of the fact that the declaration doesn't have any mechanism for implementation, and all of a sudden turned out that no one actually implements that. So that is why we're trying to push for an agreement and for a document which guarantees the implementation of it. We have only a few red lines around which we cannot agree yet. They're not something we cannot agree about. The thing is that for years and years there was no will. There was kind of a pushback. And now we are hoping that in this very new situation, with a government that includes the opposition as well, there will be new approach. Because a lot of the arguments I've heard from my colleagues is that if they sign certain thing, that's fine with them, but then the opposition will jump and destroy them. Well, now let's all see to it. The Albanian parties, the opposition will be in the transition government if it happens. I mean, if they agree around, there's a lot of optimism around this fact, but let's see. So if everyone's there on the table and if they know what are we about to sign, it means there's a national consensus on one side and there's a national consensus on the other side. So no one has to be afraid that afterwards we'll be accused of God knows what. It will be the declaration of 1999 transformed into an agreement. I don't think that it hurts anyone's national interest, or the text that we suggest are perfectly all right. The reciprocity is kept in the same dimensions as it is. It's very, very often we hear the argument, well, it's not reciprocal. Well, the declaration is not perfectly reciprocal. So if we need to transform one into another, it means that the spirit remains. Anyway, we go into too much detail here.